Hello, welcome to Holden. Today is the 14th of June, 2000. In the Creekside room this evening is Paul Olson. Today's session number is 2003, and is titled, Great Stories You Need to Know, Moral Codes in Immoral Society. Let's listen in.
Sure, that's what I do, and that's what I know most about, though my favorite argument as an English teacher is it's really fun to teach literature because you don't have to know anything. You can just grab books out of here and there that you've read and do the topic itself. I put up a bunch of dates because I'd like to cover four areas of how we develop our moral codes individually and collectively as a society. So we'll look at how do I develop my own moral codes and decide what's moral and immoral, and how do we collectively as a society do that. And African-American literature speaks to that, I think, in lots of ways, and that's what I'll share with you most of all. But I thought I'd set that up first. First of all, and those areas are, how does law affect how we decide what is moral and immoral? How do attitudes affect, and how do we develop those attitudes, and how do we inherit those attitudes? What kinds of customs and what kinds of moral values do we inherit, do we accept without really a whole lot of conscious thought? And we'll just look at those things through the literature that I'll read to you later. But first, I thought I'd start with this. Here are some very famous dates that I suppose at one time in your life you've encountered. Maybe not, because a lot of African-American history has been, you know, kind of thrown overboard. And if you're my age, in fact, you've probably hit on these laws somewhat just as political entities in American development, not so much as things having to do with slavery. So I'm going to go through them quickly, and then my question to you will be, what do all these things tell us? So, in 1619, here comes the first slave ship. Does anybody know what happened in 1620? You probably do, but the Pilgrims. So, now I just throw that out. It's interesting that before the Pilgrims come, before the Mayflower comes, we have a slave ship arriving in America. 1645, and that date's up for grabs, but I'll tell you the story. The guy's name is John Punch, and John Punch is one of three indentured servants. An indentured servant is... Yeah, good. You went to Oregon. You got that. They typically would buy their passage overseas, over to the Americas, for servitude somewhere between 4 and 7 years. And in this case, in the case of these three guys who escaped, it was 7 years. Well, John Punch and two other men escaped, were caught, brought back to trial in the territory of Maryland, and the judge sentenced all three of these, when they have caught, all three of these men to finish out their 7 years of servitude, an additional 3 years for the person that bought them or bought their passageway, and then 1 year of community service. The other two men were white, John Punch was black, and to John Punch he said, and you will serve your master for the rest of your life. With no consideration other than that, he was black. So now this becomes a part of, and that's my point in this, that here in the John Punch episode, this becomes a part of American law, based, that is, prejudicial treatment based simply on color. The man had done nothing different than the other two guys had done, other than just escape from his indentured servitude. 1787 is the Northwest Ordinance. I think we've dropped pretty much the Northwest idea now, but it was Northwest then. And north of the Ohio River would be free territory, right? So we established that. And that's why we hear one of the things that a lot of the slave spirituals are about. Going over Jordan is often code language for going over the Ohio River. We're going to get up north. And this is the Underground Railroad. It takes us north of the Ohio River. It takes us up into Kansas, too. But this is an important geographic, political bill in 1787. 1793 is the fugitive slave law, which enables the white people from the South to go get their slaves and bring them back. And it's the first, though it isn't stated deliberately, it's the first insinuation, at least, that slaves are property and that we can go get them. When our horse escapes, we can go get it. When somebody steals our wagon, we can go get it. 1808, and now we're going to get into some ambiguity, and I'll go through this real quickly. 1808, the British Isles and America outlaw African slave trade. So now on the high seas, if you're caught with Africans in your ship, you can be arrested. So oftentimes they just throw them overboard so they wouldn't be caught. 1820 is the Missouri Compromise, and this is, you did this stuff in high school, and I've got another point. That meant that Missouri entered the Union as a slave state, but the north of, which is the bottom line, of, or the southern border of Missouri, north of 3630, everywhere but Missouri would be free from then on. And Maine comes in as a free state. And what they're trying to do with the politicians is keep the balance in the legislature of slave owners and, I mean, slave states and free states. 1850 is another compromise, and that did these basically, there's other things too, but there would be no slavery in the Washington, D.C. California would come in as a free state. There would be no slavery in the territories, and this is all territory won in the Mexican War. New Mexico and Utah would decide for themselves, that's the phrase, popular sovereignty, whether or not they were going to have slavery. 1854 is another kind of compromise, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and that simply said that everything west of the Mississippi will, they'll decide for themselves, popular sovereignty, whether we're going to have slaves or not. And finally, I'm going to stop with 1857, the Dred Scott decision. You might remember that from your high school textbook, too. This guy, he's owned by somebody that takes him into free territory, lives with him there for a while. The guy comes back and dies, and Dred Scott tries to sue for his freedom. And there they decide that no Negro, free or slave, can be a citizen, therefore cannot sue, cannot bring trials against the government. He can't sue for his freedom. It also established, clearly, this has always been a debate, but it, once again, the Supreme Court is reiterating slaves are property. And finally it says that Congress cannot prohibit slavery in the territories. And they have before, but up here we've got no slavery in the territories. In other places it's going to be voted on. And my point is, if you look at all that stuff, and let me erase it now, what do you think about all of this stuff collectively? I mean, if we're real historians, we don't care about the dates. We care about what does this say about the ethos of American society. And I'm going to just let it simmer a while. Any ideas about all this stuff adds up to what?
Confusion.
It's a great word. Who said it? Okay, good job. Confusion. And I think I'll record for you some of the assessments that you give this. With what?
There's 2 steps forward. Two steps forward, but you're not based and going right back.
What's forward mean, though? Is that, well, you get some moral idea?
And change.
Okay, and the change.
Change and then no change.
And the changes in slavery policies. Yeah, okay. With slavery. And is forward, what does forward mean? If we're, I mean, to those of us in this audience, I'm sure. Forward means freedom, yeah. And step back is, we're going to enslave again. The South, of course, didn't look at it that way. This is the opposite. Okay, there's confusion. We're back and forth. Anything else? Yeah, for sure. Richard Wright says in Native Son that what's been going on over thousands of square miles and for hundreds of years is no longer debatable. It's a fact. It's a fact of our life. So along with these things that happen, we've got attitudes to go with this.
Well, it just seems like it's a problem.
Yes, that's a great response. I stop here, and we know that this goes on. We can list all kinds of dates from, that are riots, that are more legislation, everything from, you know, some of these things, Plessy versus Ferguson, that sets up separate but equal, that's later abolished, and Brown versus Board of Education, all kinds of laws that suggest America is confused. And my suggestion is going to be that that's one of the umbrellas or the foundations that we use as we listen to the literature, as these writers respond. How do all of these kind of political and geographic acts affect human spirit in the specific lives of specific people? And that's what literature does. It's going to go beyond just, we're not going to have an historical account. We're going to have the human condition and the human spirit as writers look at.
Well,
it
makes me think about your thoughts and your kind of
dilemma.
The fact that you were talking about having it balanced politically, two states and not two states,
yep.
And other people would say that it was all an economic issue,
yeah.
And so forth. But it's still a dilemma.
high school, I had a teacher tell me that in American history, the Civil War was fought over economic issues. It's crazy. The Civil War was fought over slavery. And economics were part of that, of course. Good. There's a dilemma. And what I wanted to pull out of all of this is that there's moral confusion about this, too. We surely must not have been, historically and still are not, certain about the way that our country is developing, because I know slavery is right, and yet right back there is this law. Well, we're going to outlaw slave trade. And think of something that you're sure about, and somebody else is going to pass a law that says, well, we've got to limit part of that. All of a sudden you scratch your head and say, there is moral confusion on this. And yet, out of that moral confusion, we seem to have, as a society, and again, these writers are going to point to that, come up with some pretty absolute notions about how we should live. We've developed some pretty certain, absolute kinds of moral codes, and we've accepted some kinds of traditions and customs regarding race relations that have grown out of this incredible kind of confusion that we've already seen right here over 300 years. That's a great point. And I think another thing that I'll lift up, and then we'll go to this, is that in all of his writing, especially in the great essay, I think maybe let's throw this out because our bookstore has it, one of the great essays of the 20th century, James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, suggests that America's problem is, America white people problem is guilt. And that as we looked at all these dates and the back and forth confusion and the moral dilemmas, guilt has to be riding no matter how sure we are slavery is right, but we've got to compromise. And there's something digging at us that's been a part of our moral fiber from the beginning. And that's why the first date up there, before the pilgrims came, we've got the slave ship here. And is that a part, that is for sure a part of our moral fiber. Well, enough of that. You did a great job of just kind of getting a sense of, I mean, I think that's understanding history, what you just did. What do all these bills and dates and everything, what do they do to us? Well, the writers have some ideas. And the next three notions I'd like to explore with you are attitude, custom, and the acceptance of moral values. And probably it's not clearer anywhere than it is in one of the short stories that Richard Wright, this is also in the bookstore, and I'm told I got to plug that whenever I can. And you get a 1% discount if you buy it before tomorrow. And then you got to tell her that I said that, so I have to go over and pay the 1% discount. This is attitude. And I'm just going to read the scene and let you say it afterwards. What do you observe about the characters in this scene, and what does it say about, now we're going to personalize, that's what literature does, the human spirit in the context of this kind of moral confusion? And I mentioned earlier that some pretty strong absolutes grow out of this moral confusion. The setting for this story is four young boys are skipping school. Their ages are probably 11 to 13 or so. And it's clear for the first 25 pages of the story that these are little kids. They're joking about who farts the loudest and whose mother is the prettiest or the ugliest and all kinds of things that are silly that kids do. And it's clear in our mind that these are little kids who are innocent, but not so innocent that they don't know that when the train whistle blows that train's heading north. And that north, even at 11, they already know that north means a different kind of lifestyle than it does there in the south. Well, as kids would do, it's a very hot day on this day they're skipping school, and they decide to go swimming in a swimming hole that has a sign there very obviously that says, no trespassing. They, earlier in the story, interpret that no trespassing sign for us, and what does that mean, says one kid. And the other kid responds, that means no niggers and no dogs. They know that when they go into the swimming hole. So they are innocent in the sense that they're little kids and they can skip school and they can jump in this hole, but on the other hand, they're not so innocent that they know the train, you follow me? The train goes north, it is a different life, and that, wait a minute, if we trespass on this no trespass sign, we are in for some big trouble. But they don't know what that trouble is. They can't imagine, of course, what's coming.
These are black children?
These are black children, thank you. So, just a literary thing here that's kind of fun for English teachers to do is that note that the peace and the nature, the calmness and the beauty of nature is going to be disturbed by the powerful one line when a kid says, oh, here's the peace of nature. They've been playing and talking and they grew pensive A black-winged butterfly hovered at the water's edge. A bee droned. From somewhere came the sweet scent of honeysuckles. Dimly, they could hear sparrows twittering in the woods. They rolled from side to side, letting sunshine dry their skins and warm their blood. They plucked blades of grass and chewed them. They've been swimming in their alder cake. They plucked blades of grass and chewed them. Oh. They looked up, their lips parting. Oh. A white woman. Do we understand what many of us are Northerners? What it is to be a black boy naked in front of a white woman in the South. If you remember 1954, Emmett Till, a 14-year-old kid from Chicago, went down south and said, "Bye, baby," to a woman, and her husband later sought him out and killed him. A white woman poised on the edge of the opposite embankment stood directly in front of them, her hat in her hand and her hair lit by the sun. "It's a woman," whispered Big Boy in an underbreath. "A white woman." They stared, their hands instinctively covering their groins. Then they scrambled to their feet. The white woman backed slowly out of sight. They stood for a moment looking at one another. We're going to get the sense of this, and I won't interrupt anymore. But pay attention to all the detail that the writer includes. That she's backing up, and how old are these kids? 11. She's afraid of them. And so I'm going to ask you later, why is she afraid? What is she living with? What kinds of attitudes has she inherited that these four little kids can frighten her? I mean, why not just get out of here, you guys? But enough. And just watch for all those details. They stood for a moment looking at one another. "Let's get out of here," Big Boy whispered. "Wait till she goes away. Let's run. They'll catch us here naked like this. Maybe there's a man with her. Come on, let's get our clothes," said Big Boy. They waited a moment longer, listening. "What the hell? I'm going to get my clothes," said Big Boy. Grabbing at short tufts of grass, he climbed the embankment. "Don't run out there now. Come on back, fool." Bobo hesitated. He looked at Big Boy, and then at Buck and Lester. "I'm going with Big Boy, and I'm going to get my clothes," he said. "Don't run out there naked like that fool," said Buck. "You don't know who's out there." Big Boy was climbing over the edge of the embankment. "Come on," he whispered. Bobo climbed. 25 feet away, the woman stood. She had one hand over her mouth. Hanging by fingers, Buck and Lester peeked over the edge. "Come on back. That woman's scared," said Lester. Big Boy stopped, puzzled. He looked at the woman. He looked at the bundle of clothes. Then he looked at Buck and Lester. "Come on. Let's get our clothes." He made a step. "Jim!" the woman screamed. Big Boy stopped and looked around. His hands hung loosely at his sides. The woman, her eyes wide, her hand over her mouth, backed away to the tree where their clothes lay in a heap. "Big Boy, come on back. Wait till she's gone." Big Boy, Bobo ran to Big Boy's side. "Let's go. They'll catch us here," he urged. Big Boy's throat felt tight. "Lady, we just want to get our clothes," he said. Buck and Lester climbed the embankment and stood indecisively. Big Boy ran toward the tree. "Jim!" the woman screamed. "Jim! Jim!" Black and naked, Big Boy stopped 3 feet from her. "We just want to get our clothes," he said again, his words coming mechanically. He made a motion. "You go away! You go away! I tell you, you go away!" Big Boy stopped again, afraid. Bobo ran and snatched the clothes. Buck and Lester tried to grab theirs out of his hands. "You go away! You go away! You go away!" the woman screamed. "Let's go!" said Bobo, running towards the wood. Crack! That's a rifle. Lester grunted, stiffened, and pitched forward. His forehead struck a toe of the woman's shoes. Bobo stopped, clutching the clothes. Buck whirled. Big Boy stared at Lester, his lips moving. "He's got a gun. He's got a gun," yelled Buck, running wildly. Crack! Buck stopped at the edge of the embankment. His head jerked backward. His body arched stiffly to one side. He toppled headlong, sending up a shower of bright spray to the sunlight. The creek bubbled. Big Boy and Bobo backed away, their eyes fastened fearfully on a white man who was running toward them. He had a rifle and wore an army officer's uniform. He ran to the woman's side and grabbed her hand. "Are you hurt? Are you hurt?" She stared at him, did not answer. The man turned quickly. His face was red. He raised the rifle and pointed at Bobo. Bobo ran back, holding the clothes in front of his chest. "Don't shoot me, mister. Don't shoot me." Big Boy lunged for the rifle, grabbing the barrel. "You black son of a bitch!" Big Boy clung desperately. "Let go, you black bastard!" The barrel pointed skyward. Crack! The white man, taller and heavier, flung Big Boy to the ground. Bobo dropped the clothes, ran up, and jumped onto the white man's back. "You black sons of bitches!" The white man released the rifle, jerked Bobo to the ground, and began to batter the naked boy with his fists. And then Big Boy swung, striking the man in the mouth of the barrel. His teeth caved in and he fell, dazed. Bobo was on his feet. Come on, Big Boy, let's go. Breathing hard, the white man got up and faced Big Boy. His lips were trembling, his neck and chin wet with blood. He spoke quietly. Give me that gun, boy. The scene ends with Big Boy shoots him in the building. And then Big Boy has to run and he's really in big trouble. But you can read the story to see what happens next. What do you think so far? Literary criticism starts in your guts. You don't have to let your mind work yet. Just let you feel. And work into your head.
Shock.
Yes. Yeah. Comes fast, doesn't it? Yeah. Good. Shocked. It comes so fast. And are you shocked at anything else?
Shocked you didn't say something.
Come on.
You didn't react.
Yeah. Other than just sheer panic. Four little kids. Jim. Go away. She's back up, your hands over her mouth. Little kids, what would you do? There were two kids in here watching a video when I came in. I kicked them out. No, I didn't. Get out! But you know, but they were about that age. You're the freedom. She is. Why? Because they are.
They're different.
They're different. They're black, and they are men, boys, and they are naked. And this is my swimming hole. No trespassing. You can't come here. I can't even imagine you would think about it. Good. What else? What about the man? Choo-choo.
It's just not in the way.
Surely their life is negligible. You ever had kids trample the flowers in the garden? Their own kids? I used to pick the apples off our neighbor's tree, you know, just before he had a chance to harvest them. We were out there. I mean, he'd swear at us, get the hell out of here. Get mad at us. He'd call our folks. We never go out there. God. Talk about it. Entitled. I can do this. And it's law. Slaves can't testify. And we go back to all the things we listed, and part of the things we added to that is it's law that slaves can't testify in court. Kill a nigger, it's okay, we don't have to take it to court. Frederick Douglass, in his wonderful slave narrative, talks about the woman who beats her babysitter to death and just offers to pay the person who owned the slave for it, but it's not ever worth it. They're entitled to it. Good. Good deal. I mean, it's not a big deal, and it's a good answer. Good. Completely ridiculous. Absurd. How about this line? Give me that gun, boy. What's he just done? Add up the plot here. The white man. He just killed two kids, beat the hell out of the other one. Somehow, in the struggle, you heard it, the big boy gets the gun away. And then he says, give me that gun, boy. I wrote in my margin in 1970, the first time I ever read that story, to think that he would. I can kill two of your friends, beat up the other one, and then all I have to do is say, give me that gun. Well, it's a big shock to him to pull the trigger. To think that he would.
That the only superiority of that, to kill the way, he says to do the white man.
lots of black writers, and if you have black friends, talk to them about it. We'll submit that the bottom line of prejudice is white ideas that are superior. Give me that gun, boy. I've inherited the right to kill your friends. I've inherited the right to keep you off. I've inherited the right to destroy your innocence. I've inherited the right to make an order, and you will, of course, obey. The title of the story is Big Boy Leaves Home, and he does leave home. And there's lots of wonderful themes and ideas that go on besides just the one we have. What I'm asking you to focus on, and you just did, is the attitude. There's another story, much more subtle, and in some ways just as powerful. Also in Uncle Tom's Children, this is a collection of two essay or one essay and five short stories. And in this story, we have there's no violence, which is unusual for Richard Wright, and that's a whole other thing to talk about if we want to. In this case, they just want the black people just want to have a march because they're hungry and the food distribution is unjust. And the mayor and some of his cronies, who is they're white, come over to Dan, the black pastor in the community, and they want Dan to stop the march. And I'll just read this without any stops and just ask you to pay attention to look at how the language that the white people use, the behaviors, and the kind of communication that occurred between the two. And to start off, for instance, just to set you up for these, they called Reverend Taylor. By his first name is Dan. They're not going to call him Reverend Taylor, so it starts that way. Why, hello, Dan. Good evening, Mr. Mayor. How have you been, Dan? Fairly well, with the help of God, sir. Taylor shook hands with a tall, fat, white man in a blue serge suit. It's been a long time since I've seen you, Dan. Yes, sir, it sure has, Your Honor. How's Jimmy? Just fine, sir. That's a fine boy you got, Dan. I'm sure glad to think so, sir. If you raise that boy right, he'll be a leader of his people someday, Dan. That's the one hope of my life, sir, said Taylor with deep emotion. May was telling me you're sick, said the mayor. Ah, it ain't nothing, just a summer cold, sir. I didn't mean to bother you if you're sick, Dan. That's all right, sir, I'm feeling better, much better now. Oh, you'll pull through all right. It'll take a lot more than a summer cold to kill old war horses like you and me, eh, Dan? The mayor laughed and winked. I'm hoping God spares me a few more years, sir, said Taylor. But at least you look all right now, said the mayor. Say, Dan, I want you to meet Chief Bruden. This is Dan, Chief, the boy I was telling you about. How are you, Mr. Chief? Asked Taylor. The black cigar burned red in Bruden's mouth. He shifted his thin body and growled, hello, boy. And Dan, this is Mr. Lowe, head of our fine industrial squad. How are you, sir? Said Taylor. Lowe nodded with half-closed eyes. Sit down, Dan, said the mayor. I didn't say, now it's too bad. I hadn't said it ahead of time. They're at Dan's house. Sit down, Dan, said the mayor. Yes, sir. Taylor sat on the edge of a chair and rested his palms lightly on his knees. Maybe our little visit is a surprise, huh? Asked the mayor. Yes, sir, it is, but I'm glad to be of any help I can, sir. Good. I knew you'd talk that way. Now, Dan, we want you to help us. You're a responsible man in this community, and that's why we are here. I try to do my duty as God shows it to me, sir. That's the spirit, Dan, the mayor patted Taylor's knee. Now, I'm going to be perfectly frank with you, Dan, the mayor peeled a wrapper from a black cigar. What's this? Here, have one. Thank you, sir. Taylor put the cigar into his vest pocket. I'll smoke it after dinner, sir. There was silence during which the three white men looked at Taylor. There's more of them. What do you make of that just so far? Why do they look at him? For instance, they give him, here, have a cigar. Thank you, sir. I'll smoke it after.
He's probably broken some code.
You bet he has. I'll smoke this on my time. No, Dan. Here's a cigar. You smoke it now. You don't do anything. You sit in your house and we tell you. And you're responsible.
What's the word responsible to
so the mayor?
You do the right thing.
Yeah, and the right thing, of course, right thing. Yeah. Okay. that's good. And I pointed out in my own notes here to pay attention to you did already, the notice responsible. And they talk more and more, and as the story unfolds, the march does occur, and it becomes a pretty interesting story. The last one to read out of still Uncle Tom's Children is to suggest something to you that I'm still trying to illustrate, and you've caught it for sure, the whole notion of inherited attitudes, that we've accepted these attitudes without really questioning our own responses and our own behaviors. But literature does more than just talk about or be an analysis of our society. It does more than just present social protest, and we've all felt that, you know, the injustice here and so on. It does something about, it renders clearly the human spirit. And this powerful scene, which personally I think is maybe one of the great scenes in all of American literature, is this young man named Silas is married to Sarah, and Sarah, for reasons that are worth reading the story for, gets in trouble with a white man, and Silas finds out about it. And the white man, he's a salesman, and he left his phonograph there, and then he and Sarah had sex relationships, and it's a wonderful debate whether he rapes her or if it's seduction, and if it's a white man, a black woman, you can figure out what it probably is. But Silas is very angry about this, of course, and the guy's going to come back and pick up his money the next day, and when he comes back, Silas killed him. Well, the black man has killed him. He's killed a white man, and there were two guys in the car, and the other guy took off, so guess what? They're going to be coming back with all kinds of Pennsylvania folks, and this is one of those great scenes about the effect on the individual spirit of inherited and accepted attitudes. Sarah wants Silas to run. Silas will not run. Silas, she cried, seeing blurred objects sailing through the air and hearing them hit softly in the dust. Get your things and go. Silas, ain't no use you saying nothing now. But they'll kill you. There ain't nothing I can do. And there ain't nothing you can do. You done too goddamn much already. Get your things and go. They'll kill you, Silas. He pushed her off the porch. Get your things and go to Aunt Peel's. Let's both go, Silas. I'm staying here till they come back. She grabbed his arm and he slapped her hand away. She dropped to the edge of the porch and sat looking at the ground. Go with me, she said quietly. Go away. Go away before they come. I didn't mean no harm. Go away for what? They'll kill you. It don't make no difference. He looked out over the sun-filled fields. For 10 years, I slaved my life out to get my farm free. His voice broke off, his lips moved, as though 1,000 words were spilling silently out of his mouth, as though he did not have breath enough to give them sound. He looked to the sky and then back to the dust. Now it's all gone. Gone. If I run away, I ain't got nothing. If I stay and fight, I ain't got nothing. It don't make no difference which way I go. God, God, I wish all of them white folks was dead. Dead, I tell you. I wish God would kill them all. She watched him run a few steps and stop. His throat swelled. He lifted his hands to his face. His fingers trembled, and then he bent to the ground and cried. She touched his shoulders. Silence. He began to talk to no one in particular. He simply stood over the dead white man and talked out of his life. The white folks ain't never give me a chance. They ain't never give no black man a chance. There ain't nothing in your whole life you can keep from them. They take your land, they take your freedom, they take your women, and then they take your life. He turned to her screaming. And then I get stabbed in the back by my own blood. When my eyes is on the white folks to keep them from killing me, my own blood trips me up. He knelt in the dust again and sobbed. After a bit he looked to the sky, his face wet with tears. I'm gonna be hard like they is. So help me God, I'm going to be hard. When they come for me, I'm going to be here. And when they get me out of here, they's going to know I'm gone. And if God lets me live, I'm going to make them feel it. But Lord, I don't want to be this way. Excuse me, wow. The power of a writer to embrace the spiritual dimensions and the spiritual effects of an attitude, of attitudes accepted by men like the mayor and Jim, who shoots them. But besides attitudes, we inherit customs. And three great illustrations that are real quick are come from the wonderful little novel, Not Without Laughter, by Langston Hughes, more known for his poetry. It's kind of a coming-of-age novel about a young boy named Sandy. He's black, and he's coming to his first integrated school. He's now 10 years old in the fifth grade. He's always been in all black schools before. And he's this scene is his very first day in the integrated school. "Take seats, all of you, please," the teacher rasped out. "Anywhere now, until we get order," she rapped again impatiently with the ruler. "Take seats at once. Now, write your names on the paper, turning it long ways. Nothing but your names, that's all I want today. You'll receive forms to fill out later, but I want to get your seats assigned this morning." She collects the sheets. "Now," she said, "each child rise as I call out your names, so I can see who you are. Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich, Josephine Evans," she reads the names in alphabetical order, "Franklin Rhodes, James Rogers," that's our hero, his nickname is Sandy, and Sandy stood up quickly, "Ethel Shortledge, Roland Thomas." The roll call continued, each child standing until he had been identified and then sitting down again. "Now," the teacher said, "everybody rise and make a line around the walls. Quietly, no talking. And as I call your names this time, take seats in order, starting with number one here in the first row near the window. Mary Atkins, Carl Dietrich." The roll was repeated, each child taking a seat as she had commanded. When all but four of the children were seated, the two colored girls and Sandy still were standing. "Albert Zwick," she said, and the last white child sat down in his place. "Now, you three colored children take the seats behind Albert. You girls take the first two, and you take the last one. Now, I'm going to put on the board the list of books to buy, and I want all of you to copy them correctly," and that's the end of scene one. The teacher is middle-aged. Two more scenes to connect, and I'm going to ask you about custom. The boys... all the kids, black and white, in the community have been cutting out coupons for the paper. The big carnival is coming. They're all excited about this, and for about six pages, we see how excited they are. And, Willie Mae, the little black girl that goes with Sandy to the carnival, wears her best shoes and her dress suit, and her fanciest dress. They head off. They're so excited they forget to take their coupons. Their grandma calls them back to get the coupons. My point is just to build up their enthusiasm and their excitement. And then it was a long walk to the park, and Willie Mae stopped and took off her shoes and stockings, remember they're new, and carried them in her hands until she got near the gate, and then she put them on again. They could hear the band playing and children shouting and squealing as the cars on the chute-de-chutes shot down with a splash into the pond. They could see the giant Ferris wheel. "I'm going to ride on that first," said Sandy. There were crowds of children under the bright red and white wooden shelter at the park entrance. They were lining up at the gate. They were almost now to the entrance. There were just two boys in front of them. Willie Mae held out her black little hand, clutching the coupons. They moved forward. The man looked down. "Sorry. This party's for white kids." Willie Mae did not understand that these kids are 10. She stood holding out the coupons, waiting for the tall white man to take them. "Stand back, you two," he said, not unkindly. "I told you, little darkies, this isn't your party. Come on now, next little girl." Kids walk away. They're angry, they're hurt, they're confused, they don't get it. She walked away, followed by five or six other little girls in their Sunday dresses. Willie Mae was sitting on the ground, taking off her shoes again, sweat and tears running down her black cheeks. Sandy saw his white schoolmate, and these guys are good friends, Earl, approaching. "What's the matter, Sandy? Ain't you going in? Did Willie Mae hurt her foot?" "No," said Sandy. We just ain't going in." "Here, Earl, you can have my coupons. If you have extra ones, the paper says you get more lemonade, so you take my coupons." The white boy, puzzled, accepted the offered coupons, stood dumbly for a moment, wondering what to say to his brown friend, then went into the park. What customs? And then, therefore, what attitudes?
Sammy, after he was rejected, what he wanted to do, he felt like what he had.
Give up what he had?
Yeah. Yeah. Just keep that.
Is there useless?
Yeah, good point.
What are the attitudes of these people who have power? That's my made it clear to us, I hope we all understand it, that racism involves power. The teacher has power. Their attitude is?
If a white person overheard this, why didn't they stick out that reflection of his? Why didn't they stick up for that reflection? Would somebody have to feel so weak that they have to join in the crowd and the others are abusing them for no reason?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the answer in the story is that the only white person there is the teacher. And these are all little kids who probably don't dare confront the teacher on that.
But that, you raise a great point.
Her attitude? And how old is she? She's a teacher, we aren't told. But yes, at least she's got to be. How old? Okay, she's 30. How old's the guy at the gate?
Sorry, he says not on time. This party's for white kids. How old is he?
Well, we don't know. But who's going to be at carnival?
20s,
okay. Do they have any options? In this confused moral society that's been going on with its dilemmas and its confusion for centuries, this guy at the gate is not confused. He is absolute. Sorry, this party's for white kids. He doesn't say it up. Get out of here, you... He doesn't... Okay. Sorry. But he's 20 years old. At least. He's an adult. What are his options? In real life, without moral absolutes handed down to him, what are some of his options? Well, he doesn't because he's accepted these. Sorry, I hate to do this, but I have to. So, on one hand, you are absolutely right, except the sun's going to come up if he doesn't. You know, one of the wonderful ideas in all of black literature, especially in Richard Wright, I think, is that writers help us clarify the difference between absolute laws and artificial laws. Artificial laws can be broken. You can cheat against them. Absolute laws, like gravity, you can't cheat against gravity. Jump off a two-story building, you're going to wreck your arches. You can't cheat. I mean, no matter where you are, no matter what culture, I mean, that's an absolute law. But social laws aren't absolute. We can cheat against them. Great point, but one of his options is, I'll take you. Another option is, I won't. Name them. He's got a lot of options.
Well, he can pretend he didn't see. I'm going to look this way. You guys go in and blow
sure.
it up.
Yep.
But then, at the same time, do you think if he did do that somehow, first of all, it would reflect on incompetence?
Oh, you... Of course it would. He's going to have, no matter what he chooses to do, he's going to have consequences. And you raise a great point. And the consequences of this are pretty simple, right? Because this is the way the law is. This is the rules. And nobody's going to fire me. Nobody's going to, you know, call me incompetent. I'm doing my job. But he could turn his head. He could go in there with them. He could. I'm not going to do this job. I'm going to quit. I can't do it. I mean, all those, you know, you study Holocaust literature, all those people that escorted the capos, the Jews themselves, escorted their fellow people into the showers, they could refuse to do it. They'd get shot, but it was an option. So it's not a good option. They have no choice.
The
one
thing, and something about that, I think, is one of the lessons of from Schindler List, is the fact that you have to identify with the enemy and change the leader's heart so that he can approach things and look at an angle and really see what's going on. And granted, you're right, if he would have stood up and said, this is not right, the teacher would have stood up, chances are he probably would have been fired from his job, so he realized he didn't want to risk that.
That's another option. I'm just going to go talk. That's good. That's a great point, too. How about Earl? He's 10. You expect him to get it. Sandy, why aren't you going?
Sure.
Sure, he's not going to give it up. And he's 10. And can you explain race behavior? Can you explain apartheid? You know, that's the South African word, but that's what we have. Can we explain that? It's okay.
He's still trying to speak to God.
Sure. Here's the question for you on this acceptance of attitudes and acceptance of customs and morals. At what age can we expect someone to think responsibly about how they accept their hand-to-hand values? Ken? Anybody here that doesn't excuse Earl?
Ken.
What about the teacher? You said she was 30. Did she know better? Go ahead.
Does Earl know what he's saying? Because Sandy says for him, he's hard to get work for the civil law to get.
We're not going in? Yeah.
Sandy doesn't say, I'm not going in because I'm black. And I'm not black.
That's right. You're right. He doesn't
explain it. Because he's, you know, he's sort of, he's too proud.
Sure.
So he's a second race.
Yep.
And I have a 10-year-old at home. I don't know that they would get it.
Right.
Just seeing their friend not
there. Sure.
So I'm willing to excuse them.
Yeah, I think probably all are. Are you going to excuse the guy at the gate?
No.
Are you going to excuse the teacher?
No.
Well, how about 11? What if Earl were 11? How about 12? You get the point, right? 13, 14, 15, where? And what is it that makes our consciousness pricked enough to start to ask these questions that all of a sudden I'm not going to just accept these values that have been handed down, these customs?
Thinking back to our high school, our young college kids, that brings a lot of life.
Yeah. And what are the... question I like to ask my students in classes is, who decided this for me? And when do we become responsible and free to make those value decisions for ourselves? Somebody decided for that teacher that this is how she will live her life and this will be her moral code. I will make sure that we continue with the apartheid, the segregation, and discrimination that we have. Who decided that for her? Who decided for Jim that he can shoot these kids without any consequences? And what kind of all those history times we had up there, dates, how does that get in the mix of what we just see kind of evolve without some kind of conscious look at it all? The last, I have 3 minutes, a great scene. It's a funny one, and I love telling this, reading the story, because when I do, I think of... When I was, I have two sons, and now they're 24 and 23, but I can remember all three of us in the bathtub. They were 2 and 3. And we're just, you know, give me the rubber ducky and pass the soap and all. We're just having a good time in the bathtub. And all of a sudden, we're all naked, of course, and all of a sudden, my older son looks at me and he goes like this, whoop! Right between the legs. Gotcha! And I didn't get mad. He's a little kid, right? I'm setting that story up to say we understand innocence and the silliness of kids playing, and watch this episode from Richard Wright's Black Boy. Richard Wright, as a little boy, is being bathed by his grandmother. And she's up in the sink, and the sink up on the counter, and she says, "Bend over," she ordered. I stooped, and she scrubbed my back. My mind was in a sort of daze, midway between daydreaming and thinking, and then before I knew it, words whose meaning I did not fully know, had slipped out of my mouth. "When you get through back there, Granny, kiss." The words rolling softly but unpremeditatedly off my lips. He didn't say, "Kiss my ass." He just said, "When you get through back there, kiss." Okay. My first indication that something was wrong was that Granny became terribly still. Then she pushed me violently from her. I turned around and saw that her white face, his grandmother's very light skin, was frozen, his grandmother, that her black, deep-set eyes were blazing at me unblinkingly. Taking my cue from her queer expression, I knew I had said something awful. But I had no notion at that moment just how awful it was. Granny rose slowly and lifted the wet towel high above her head and brought it down across my naked back with all the outraged fury of her 60-odd-year-old body could, leaving an aching streak of fire burning and quivering on my skin. And that's why I told you the story about myself and my little kids. This is kid stuff. This is fun stuff. But look how serious it's taken. She lifted the wet towel and struck me again with such force that I dropped to my knees. I knew that if I did not get out of her reach, she would kill me. Naked, I rose and ran out of the room screaming. My mother hurried from her bed. "What's the matter, Mama?" she asked Granny. I lingered in the hallway, trembling, looking at Granny, trying to speak, but only moving my lips. "Richard, what have you done?" my mother asked. Poised to run again, I just shook my head. "What's the matter, for God's sake?" my mother asked of me, of Granny, of my brother, turning her face from one to the other. Granny wilted, half-turned, flung the towel to her floor, then burst into tears. Again, I tell the story of myself in the bathtub with my kids. I didn't cry. I didn't get any. It was just, okay, she burst into, I was trying to wash him, and that black little devil, he told me to kiss him there when I was through. Now my mother stared without speaking. "No," my mother exclaimed. "He did," Granny whimpered. "He didn't say that." "He did," Granny sighed. I listened, vaguely knowing now that I had committed some awful wrong that I could not undo and that I had uttered words I could not recall, even though I ached to nullify them, kill them, turn back time to the moment before I had talked so that I could have another chance to save myself. "Come here, you little filthy fool," my mother called. I dodged her and ran back into the house and again into the hallway, my naked body flashing frantically through the air. "You may as well stand still. I'm going to beat you tonight if it's the last thing I do on this earth," said my mother. Again she charged me. I dodged, just missing the swinging swish of the wet towel, and scooted into the room where my brother stood. "What's the matter?" he asked, for he had not heard what I had said. A blow fell on my mouth. I whirled. Granny was upon me. She struck me another blow on my head with the back of her hand, and then my mother came into the room. I fell to the floor and crawled under the bed. "You come out of there," my mother called. "No," I cried. "Come out or I'll beat you to within an inch of your life." "No," I said. "Call Papa," Granny said. Grandpa came and ordered me from under the bed. I refused to move out. "Come out of there, little man." "No." "Do you want me to get my gun?" "No, sir. Please don't shoot me," I cried. "Then come out. Come out and get your whipping." I remained still. The bed moved and I moved. I did not think. I did not plan. I did not plot. Instinct told me what to do. There was painful danger and I had to avoid it. Grandpa finally gave up and went back to his room. "When you come out, you'll get your whipping. No matter how long you stay under there, you're going to get it. And no food for you tonight." "What did he do?" my brother asked. "Something he ought to be killed for," Randy said. Now, this is within a black family. Told by a black, by Richard Dreyfuss. What's going on? What about moral codes? You better not show disrespect, that's right, of any kind. So do they love this kid? So, kiss back there, not even, again, not kiss back, kiss the little kid, the innocence of all this. Something he should be killed for. Because he can be killed, him, for disrespect out there in that world where there are no trespassing signs. That trespassing sign becomes a metaphor for a whole lot of things, lines you cannot cross. So there within the family, no white people around, a moral code is developed in how do you teach your kids to survive? And to what lengths do you go to keep your kids so they know how to survive? And then we think again, good.
I'm just thinking it's too easy for us not to have sympathy with the white people. I was thinking this ticket taker, we're unable to give at 20. We don't know what happened to him. Similar to that, where he might have reached out to a black kid and gotten whipped in the same way.
Sure.
And because it looks like, in the context he was in, he did the best he could to be kind and benevolent for his kid.
Yep.
So, in his inheritance, that might have been as difficult a phrase as it might be for Richard Wright, when he's not the younger.
Yep. It's a great point. And then we have that phrase, the overlap of attitudinal and institutional racism. And when does do attitudes become almost institutionalized in the school, in the church, at the carnival, in the home? That these attitudes are so set in stone because it's the only way to survive. And the white guy, I mean, you can't be an ear lover, right? So, and we have vulgar phrase liberty, of course.
So the talent is ingrained in the black families so that they can kind of train their kids to survive.
Well, I wouldn't want to generalize like that. In this case, that is true. And throughout Black Boy, he is whipped all the time, and his parents, his grandmother and his mother, the opening scene is they beat him almost to death. He has a temperature of 106. He's in a coma, you know, kind of a sub-D coma for 4 days. But they love him. But they know that you have to learn that you have to follow every single rule of the Ten Commandments. What all this comes to, and I had this stuff on the board earlier, in the midst of this confusion, look what kinds of things are handed down deliberately, and that we accept sometimes thoughtlessly, but then again with great empathy for those of us who have been affected by, we all are, white and black, by all of this confusion. And I think what writers ask us to do is to be conscious of the kinds of attitudes and values that we accept, and to be conscious of the complexity of all those things. Maybe my own last phrase would be, we play the game with history. Whether we're affected by history, whether we play the game or not. I don't want to play the game. You can't stay out of it. And then to be aware of those historical forces that are law, custom, attitude, and moral values handed down. Being aware is what the writer, I think, is attempting to do. Via the great intensity of human emotion, like, I don't want to be this way. Anybody else? Anything?
I think that's a gentle sense of racial difference. You didn't have any stuff.
Yep.
And then you didn't have any stuff. Everybody's going to suspect. My kids are going to obey what I say. I mean, I've seen it.
Yep. Well, that's a great point, and I think one of the reasons a white person can teach black literature, and that used to be a debate 30 years ago, I don't know anymore, is that all of this literature transcends race, it transcends gender, because it touches the vulnerable of the human spirit, the most fundamental part of what makes us human. So, you're right. Anybody else? Anything? This is in the bookstore. This is in the bookstore. I referred to the fire next time. That's in the bookstore. And thank you.